What's up, Internet? Welcome back to the Engadget Podcast. I'm Senior Editor Devendra Hardwar. This week, joined by Senior Reviewer or Reporter Igor Bonifacic. Hello, Igor.
Hey, Devendra. Thanks so much for having me.
Happy to have you here, Igor. And also, Podcast Producer Ben Elman. Hey, Ben.
Hello, everybody.
Hello. This is a special episode, folks, because this is actually episode 300. We started this right before the pandemic began, the fall of 2019. We were recording in office. It was such a different time, but we have survived. Folks, thank you for following us along the way. And this week, we're going to be diving into some big news, specifically the whole Xbox reshuffle that was announced last week, which, if you've been following our discussions around Xbox and kind of how messed up that whole segment of Microsoft's business is, it's certainly another interesting, you know, milestone there for them. Things are definitely going to be changing there. And we're going to be talking about Samsung's Galaxy Unpacked event, or just the Samsung Unpacked event, where they announced the Galaxy S26 family, their new buds, all that fun stuff. As always, folks, if you're enjoying the show, please be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Leave us a review on iTunes and drop us an email at podcastengadget.com. I would love for our iTunes rating to be higher. I feel like we're getting some mean ratings there, but also, I don't know. I'm sure I'm pissing people off with things I say. I can't help it, folks.
There are so many people who are like, I don't want my gadget show to be political.
I can't. You know, I'm sorry, reality.
I'm sorry, that's about to happen later in this episode, too, when we talk about Discord and age verification. I'm sorry, privacy is political.
You can drop us an email at podcastengadget.com, send us your notes, whatever, and send it if you like the show. Yeah, just throw us a review there. And also Pocket Cast, we'd love to see reviews and stars there. Let's talk about what's going on at Xbox, and it's kind of a lot. You know, I feel like for mainstream gamers, they probably won't notice. But last week, it was revealed that Xbox head and Microsoft gaming head Phil Spencer is leaving Microsoft. He says he's going to be retiring. Replacing him is Asha Sharma, the president of Microsoft's core AI division. She's going to be taking that over. Sarah Bond, the person who... who's currently the president of Xbox, and a lot of people thought would be the successor to Phil Spencer. She's the one that's been out there publicly over the last few years talking about like what Xbox is doing, going to be doing for next generation hardware. She's the one who kind of spearheaded that whole everything is an Xbox campaign. She's kind of been the face of Xbox for years. And then Matt Booty is also sticking around as well. What was his specific role? Matt Booty, current head of Xbox Game Studio, is going to be promoted to chief content officer. And it also kind of feels like he is now being vetted to like go up to lead all of Xbox eventually. But some big changes here. And if you're not paying attention, it's kind of weird. Phil Spencer is the guy who basically, I believe, came in to help like fix some of the issues after the Xbox One launch. He has been at Microsoft for years. He is a lifer. But he is dedicated to Microsoft and he cares about Xbox. Asha Sharma, I know she's worked on the AI side. It is very strange to see an AI executive being brought over to lead something that is completely non-AI. Microsoft has talked a bit about AI coming into Xbox, like the Copilot gaming stuff, but not really. So this is a weird shuffle. And it does have me thinking about like where Xbox is headed or how much trouble it's in. Igor, you're a gamer. I'm sure you've been following this stuff too. Like, did anything feel? What was your initial reaction to this news?
Oh, I think just dismay, right? Mm-hmm. Not that like I don't, you know. I think Phil did a great job at the start of his tenure. You know, really reversing who was the previous head, the one that it was the really disastrous launch of Xbox One.
I have to look at the launch of Xbox One. There were multiple people in charge.
But I mean, famously, I remember, you know, having won the 360 generation, they were like, gaming is done. Now it is like about, and like, you know, DRM on the, you know, famously, they like, if you couldn't like, there was something, some DRM that really like the positioning around that really just didn't do them any favors. Mm-hmm. You know, it allowed Sony to really come out punching and reclaim the title, right?
It was Don Matrick, I believe. Like one of those people is Don
Matrick. Yes, yeah. Don Matrick. It was Don Matrick. Yeah. So I think initially Phil did a good job, but I think to your point, he really was just kind of a Microsoft guy, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, he might have worn like the t-shirts that everyone loved, right? But he was just executing on a corporate strategy that I think now that we look back at it, even at the time, you could see that there were some problems with it. Like, for instance, mm-hmm. just spending so much money on acquiring studios without really a plan on how to, like, you know, allow them to operate independently and in a way that, like, allows them to be successful. You know, already we've seen some, like, incredible studios shut down, right? Like, the one that comes to my mind is Arkane Austin, right? Which famously did the amazing Prey game. But then, you know, through kind of corporate, like, control was forced to make a live service game, right? And then that was shut down.
Immediately died, yeah.
Redfall. Immediately died, right, Redfall. So, and I think this is, you know, we're going to be living with the, like, the outcome of these decisions by Microsoft. You know, consolidation is never good in any industry, right? But I think it has been especially harmful in gaming where we're just seeing these really, like, talented studios get scooped up and then mm-hmm. kind of torn asunder. You know, just last week, I think it was Bluepoint got shut down by Sony. They did a tremendous job, obviously, remaking Shadow of the Colossus and Demon's Souls. Mm-hmm. So as for Asha, I think the thinking here is that she was previously an executive at Instacart, helped build that platform. And I think, you know, I think there are some people, I've seen some conversations that, you know, this is kind of, they're preparing to shut down Xbox. I don't think that's quite it. I think this is their head
faster for Microsoft too.
Yeah.
At this point. Yeah.
So I think they're making a bit of a hedge, but how successful it will be, I don't know. Like, I think they need to fundamentally rethink how they do this, right? Like,
it's so there's multiple things going on here. Asha Sharma, I've seen her name attached to some AI stuff. She does feel like somebody who is very much Microsoft manager, right? That is her job. That is her role. And that is the thing people always talk about Microsoft. Like, it is a company of middle managers climbing up, trying to run different things. You don't necessarily have to be like a dedicated gamer or even somebody who knows a lot about games to run one of these companies, right? Some of the most successful ones are just like people who are good at being executives and being leaders. Reggie Fils-Aimé, not necessarily a gamer dude. He came over from Pepsi and was it Pizza Hut or something? Like, he's,
I think so, yes.
Big corporate guy. So you have to have that energy. And then hopefully you have people under you and people around you who know the specifics of that industry and can kind of help you along. But it does kind of feel like this is rough. This is just rough news. First of all, Phil Spencer was probably on his way out for a while. It feels rough to me that they pushed Sarah Bond out like this. I've seen some reporting from Tom Warren and others who are saying that, you know, people really didn't like her management style. She did not make herself many friends there. And a lot of people just didn't like the I'm an Xbox campaign, which was that thing where every device essentially became an Xbox. And that was a way to sell cloud gaming and the way to sell that, you know, you could play Xbox games on mobile. You could play them on cloud all over the place. I recall a lot of people were just making fun of that. So, you know, it's a shame too, because she's also one of the rare, like, actual Black executives in a tech company. And instead of sticking around, she just is like, I'm going to bounce. I'm going to leave because you guys didn't respect me enough to give me the job I was working for. So that is really, really rough. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, you know, now that you mention it, to your point, like, I think one of the important, we have to talk about in terms of Phil's legacy is, you know, Game Pass, right? And Aaron, the EIC of Engadget, made a great point, is like, if everything's an Xbox, then nothing is an Xbox, right? And I think that campaign in conjunction with Game Pass has done a lot of harm to, like, the ceiling for what this platform can do, because, you know, I think Game Pass has really just, you know, they bought Call of Duty and then it ate into Call of Duty sales, right? Mm-hmm. Like, so I think it has really complicated the business model for the industry as a whole. Mm-hmm. There's just no way that it makes economical sense to, like, games in Canada now cost $100, right? How do you, like, yeah. go from
we need a game... like a multi-part Netflix series to deconstruct everything that went wrong at Xbox here, which is why I just wanted to have this conversation. You are right, Igor, that Game Pass kind of did that, but Game Pass itself was a response to the failure of the Xbox One, right? Like, broad things we have to keep in mind. I think Microsoft only ever had one successful gaming generation, and that was the Xbox 360. And that was after they lost $4 billion on the original Xbox, which they just killed early because they knew it wasn't going anywhere, right? It was not making inroads in Japan, in Europe. But they were able to basically take, you know, learn from that failure and also bring in something new that consoles didn't have, which was online gaming and Xbox Live. And they pioneered that. And that was their claim to fame for 360. That's why it worked.
To my understanding, it was actually that the original big black Xbox with the, you know, original, incredibly difficult to hold controllers. Yeah. That was a platform for Halo. That was to bring Halo to a new mass of people. And then the 360 succeeded because it got both Halo 2 and Halo 3, which were some of the biggest games of their generation outside of which new Grand Theft Auto was it at the time.
Yeah. But I mean, Halo is one thing, but the first Xbox had no third party support, like very little. It was mainly a Microsoft system, but the 360 became the thing. I kind of think of it as like the Dreamcast 2.0 because it had that. It's like, oh, connectivity is a big thing. The whole white marketing campaign, I believe a Sega executive came over to work on the 360 rollout too. But the 360 era was just like, oh man, games can be online. You can have, you could talk to your friends on headsets. Like, it can all be so seamless. They did so much right there, and then it immediately fell apart. Like, they Microsofted it with the Xbox One, right? Because they came off this unbridled success to be like, oh, you got this box here. Well, how much Microsoft bullshit can we put into this? It's going to ship with Kinect. So it's going to be $100 more expensive than the PlayStation 4. It can do Skype. Everybody wants to Skype in their living rooms, right? It can have all the corporate, synchronicity. You can have all these hooks into all this Microsoft stuff. It can hook into your cable box and do all these different things. And meanwhile, Sony's like, our box plays games. And it does it for $100 less than you, and it has more games. Done. The battle was done. There was no coming back from that. Go ahead, Igor.
Yeah, the one thing I think that is often forgotten in the 360 era is that, like, you know, for all the flack he gets, Steve Ballmer, like, you know, when the Red Ring of Death came around, and I think that
I had to send my unit in. Yeah.
Yeah, and like
I did too.
You know, the Red Ring, like, people forget, like, that was a failure rate, like, unheard of in consumer electronics, right? And Ballmer was just like, no, we'll backstop it and, like, you know, extend the warranties and stuff, right? And, you know,
if you paid to get it fixed, which was like $150, they sent you a check to refund it too. So that was nice.
Yeah. So, you know, like, I don't think that, like, Xbox has had that kind of, I mean, I guess you can make the argument with the purchases that they've had that kind of support, but I feel like, you know, there was just a different kind of relationship between the top of the company and the division than there is now, where I think, like, I'm of the opinion that Satya just needs to go, but, like, you know, that's a separate. Yeah.
It's I liked Satya as a Microsoft executive when he came in to just be like, he's going to focus on productivity and the nitty gritty of Microsoft. And like, hey, it was mainly cloud stuff. Like, that's harmless. Sure. Invest in the cloud. That's good business for you. Fine. Boring, but that's Microsoft. That's fine. And then somehow he caught the AI bug. And I feel like Satya just AI, all the things, the Copilot everywhere. And it's, again, classic Microsoft. It's like shoving a Kinect where it doesn't belong to in a way that harms the product for the people who actually would want to use those products too. So that's kind of where Microsoft is right now. I do wonder how much of this is on Phil Spencer, because how much of the issues came down from Satya, famously not a person who understands games, not really a gamer either, and didn't quite know what to do with this whole division. They allowed them to make these acquisitions. Certainly, you know, Bethesda and everything else, like those are all huge, huge deals. But beyond that, like, it doesn't seem like they had a plan. And I also have to say, it just seemed like a whole run of bad luck too, right? It's like the pandemic hit them hard. They didn't have a good response to that. Their lineup of games that were supposed to sell the Xbox Series X, Halo Infinite, delayed for a full year. And by the time it came out, it was just like a nothing burger. Redfall, another fail of a thing that they own. Just seems like fail after fail. And at the very least, Sony has had decades of investing in studios that make high-quality single-player first, you know, high-quality first-party games. And they could survive on that. They can run with that pretty well. I think they innovated better with the PlayStation 5, certainly with the DualSense controller. Felt new and different in ways that playing the Xbox Series X certainly doesn't. That just feels like a faster Xbox One. And then, hey, Nintendo's here too. But Nintendo's just like such a special company doing their own thing, always doing their own thing. It feels like among the high-end console market, it is really just Microsoft and Sony. So that's the history. That's kind of why we are where we are right now. What we were expecting, hearing from Sarah Bond, was that we would see some powerful new next-generation hardware that is essentially just a Windows PC and will likely be much more expensive than even something like the PlayStation 5 Pro. How does that work? Because I just, yeah, how does that work? I just reviewed the Falcon Northwest Fragbox, which is an insanely expensive desktop, plugged into my home theater. I was like, how does home theater PC gaming look right now? It doesn't look good.
You need Buzzite, right? Like,
You need, even if you turn on Steam Big Picture Mode or whatever, like, it's like, I used to do Windows gaming on my TV like a decade ago. I would just string a big HDMI cable over. It is just as bad. It is just as annoying to get the settings right, to get everything like working properly. It is not a great experience. And so, yeah, you need those Linux tools. We've talked about this. Microsoft kind of missed the boat and let Valve just come in and be like, hey, we can make Windows games work good on Linux. How did they let that happen? So the whole portable PC thing missed by Microsoft. We're waiting for the Steam machines, which is essentially a tiny little PC that can play those games too. Again, it seems like another big miss. Where do you see things going for Xbox, Igor? I'm just like, I'm looking at this, having covered this for so long, being like, how do you guys keep screwing up? How do you not see some of these things?
I honestly don't know, because, you know, so there was a report in its earnings, HP said that like RAM now accounts for 35% of the cost of a new PC. So that's like, I think, the second biggest PC maker, right? And so
it's like double what it used to cost.
So double, more than double. Yeah. So I just think it's become untenable, right? Where already like the price of a PlayStation like 5 and an Xbox Series X was too much, right? Mm-hmm. And as we've seen, you know, one of the like unlucky breaks that you kind of alluded to is that like the tariffs, Microsoft has just like given up on, like, they can't, I guess the margins just were not there for them to take on the hit from that. And they've just increased the price of like the Xbox Series X and Series S, right? Where now those consoles just don't make sense to buy, right?
Buy them. There's no reason to buy them.
Yeah. There's no reason, right? And so this next generation system, which apparently is going to be a Windows PC, like, how do you spec that, right? And to make it cost effective. And like, so I just, you know, like in all of this, you know, you said Nintendo is a special case, but I think they're really like, they're going to be fine because they spec their system lower, right? It's like a 5-nanometer chip. It has less RAM. It's all older components that are not as susceptible to the creep of these prices, right? And
they make mistakes. Like when Nintendo makes a mistake, they can reverse course really quickly. I was there for the Wii U launch. I bought I didn't buy the Virtual Boy, but I saw the Virtual Boy. But the initial 3DS launch was a disaster too. They had to give people credit and free games because it was a mess. So, you know.
Yeah.
I feel like, I know, looking at it right now, be like, what should have happened? I wish Microsoft was paying attention. Was like the Xbox Series X should have been that. It should have just been, hey, here's the key to how we're entering the consoles. This is a PC. So you can do all your stuff. You could do Windows stuff. You could play, you know, have a console-like experience. But also if you want to install other things, as we're seeing with the Mac Minis, people love a little $500 PC box. You could do so much with that. That could be a server. That could be a secondary machine in your home. That could be your main PC. It is so funny that Microsoft forgot that, hey, we're the PC company. We're the Windows company. We could be doing this. And meanwhile, Valve is out there reverse, and the certain engineers who did this, reverse engineering Windows gaming into Linux. How do you let that happen? That is very much the Tony Stark built this in a cave. How can you not do this? Such a Microsoft problem. But it seems like, yeah, the thing, if I were in charge of Xbox right now, it'd be like gun to everybody's head. No, it would be like, hey, get Windows working on these things. Just get that Windows down. You should be on parity with the performance of the Steam Deck or Steam Machine. Like that same level of parity of Windows gaming on Linux. Make that happen. I think the worry for a lot of people is like, hey, people are going to buy these things and put Steam on it. And I don't think you can avoid that. Like if that's the joy, that's PCs, but also that's still your platform. So make people not want to just live on Steam, right? Make Game Pass the thing that is actually maybe more useful and more enjoyable to people. Game Pass is your way to sell those games, or at least to keep people on your platform. When I was playing Game Pass games, that was the thing keeping me from launching up Steam, you know? And then I would be annoyed because I couldn't easily play those games on my Steam Deck. And then you start to feel that platform hit. We shall see, folks, but it seems like Microsoft is in weird territory. I'm not going to judge Asha Sharma too harshly here because she just seems like a corporate management drone here. There is some weird like pro-natalist stuff I've seen people talking about. I'm like, I don't know what's going on here. What is everybody thinking or smoking over there in the tech world, both in Silicon Valley and in the Pacific Northwest? I don't know who these people are reading or who they're talking to. We will see.
I'd never heard of Asha Sharma before, but when a article from Cecilia D'Anastasio at Bloomberg came up saying, like, here she is, she's the new head of Xbox with the nice corporate portrait, all I could think was, surely gamers will be normal about this.
Yeah. So I'm not going to criticize. There's not much to criticize other than the weird pronatalist stuff. Gamers are going to be gross about it.
Well, but I personally haven't seen it. Maybe that's a sign of how well I've filtered that noise out of my life, though. If you have, please email us with some examples. podcast@engadget.com.
I mean, we don't need to see that. It's fine.
I want to see it.
It's totally fine. But I will say this. Last year I wrote a piece saying Xbox 2025 was the year Xbox died. It does feel like that is the ultimate culmination of like all of that is kind of happening now. It'll be interesting to see what the next stages are. What do you want Microsoft to do? Like, what do you think would be the good move? It almost seems like they kind of have to do the first gen Xbox thing, like cut your losses early and try to rush out your hardware, new hardware that is actually innovative. And if the delays of the PlayStation 6 are true, and the reports are that it'll likely be delayed by up to 2 years, so maybe...
2 years?
2 years.
That's more than the last estimate that we were talking about, what, like last week, 2 weeks ago?
I've seen a year to 2 years. It really depends. But it was initially expected in like 2027. Could be 2028. Could be 2029. If Microsoft hunkers down and just... makes a box and optimizes Windows and tries to like reshape its platform in a year or two, they could be out early before that thing. Yeah.
I think the problem here though is that like the rot at the center of Microsoft is Windows, right? And I think until they like really take a step back and I was reading one thing where it said like, I think it's only 3.5% of Copilot Office 365 seats pay for Copilot. And they're pushing that on everyone, right? And so many of like the issues with the OS just comes down to they're not sticking to fundamentals, you know, working on the things that people actually care about, performance, security, and all these things. And instead trying to force these AI tools that people don't want to use. You know, there's so many people who are looking for just an excuse to leave, Windows. I'm one of those people, like to the point where I kind of regret buying a NVIDIA GPU because it's so much easier. The drivers on Linux from AMD are so much better for Linux, although, you know, that is something that NVIDIA is working on. But there's just like competing priorities at the company, and I don't think they're really necessarily complementary to one another anymore.
I will say, so I've talked to some Microsoft executives recently who are like, they are well aware that people do not like the AI stuff in Windows. They are well aware that people are annoyed about Windows, and they say they're working on like getting back to fundamentals this year and delivering some fixes and stuff, but they just rolled out a Windows update that bricked machines. You know, they're still like mostly talking about AI stuff. I will believe it when I can see it. I'm also in the middle of writing a piece right now about, it's probably a good time for Apple to have a cheap MacBook, huh? Probably just like, why even be on Windows? Like, if you can be on a Mac, especially at a cheaper Mac, and be on a platform that's more secure and stable, and yeah, there's AI stuff, but you could just ignore Apple Intelligence entirely. Why even use Windows? That is a big problem for Microsoft. I'm a Windows user. I grew up on Windows. I use Windows 3.1. I've been building my own computers since the year 2000. I know the ins and outs. I used to be Windows IT guy. I still am most comfortable in Windows, you know, but that's mainly for the games these days. Like, if Macs could do everything, I'd be running a Mac desktop right now. I'm definitely going to look more into Linux gaming, and I'm excited to see what the Steam machines bring. And all of this comes down is basically because Microsoft is so, like, so short-sighted and chasing, like, the next shiny thing. And for them, AI was the shiny thing. And it's a shame. It's a shame to just, like, look back at this company, which I've liked a lot of their products, but what consumer-facing product from Microsoft do people actually like? I've been thinking about that. I feel like Xbox is the only one. Because nobody's out there being, I love Windows, I love Copilot, I love Skype. It's nothing. There's nothing else. Maybe the cloud people are like, I love Azure. I actually know cloud people who love Azure, but they're not consumers. They're like corporate database, you know, fiends. Xbox is what they've got. It's really sad to see them continually mess this up. I'm hoping things shape up moving forward, though. All right. The other big thing that happened this week is Samsung's Galaxy Unpacked event, or just Samsung Unpacked. We had coverage from California and from London, I believe, too. We had dueling coverage on this thing. Samsung announced the S26, S26 Plus, and Ultra. No super thin edge phone this year. That's interesting. And also the Buds 4 and the Buds 4 Pro. What struck me about these phones is that they look exactly the same as last year's phones. Like, not... They didn't even try. They didn't even try to be different. Igor, are you at all intrigued by these things?
No. Just flat out. So let me just start with...
Wait. Igor, you have to tell us your biases. What phone is in your pocket or on your desk right now?
So I have an old iPhone 12 and a Pixel 10a.
There you go.
That my two, so...
Okay, all right.
You know.
Balanced.
Balanced, somewhat. Yeah, I think... So the thing is... Okay, let's start with the S26 Ultra because it is the one, it has one innovative feature, and it is the most innovative feature that Samsung has probably put out in the last 5 years,
yes.
Which is saying something. So it is a privacy display. What essentially what you can do is it will like pixelate the screen when if people are looking from unideal viewing angles, if I understand correctly. And you can do it on like kind of a per app basis. It looks really cool. Dev and I were talking about this before we started recording, and there are third-party device accessories that do this, but yeah, they don't do it anywhere near. Yeah, they don't do it anywhere near as good as this seems in the video that in the hands-on we saw.
What's cool is that it is literally built into the screen, like it is shifting pixels and the way pixels are displayed. And I was sitting watching this event being incredibly bored and trying not to fall asleep. And then I saw this thing. It's like, Samsung, why don't you lead with this? Nobody's done this before. So this is, you turn on this feature and it immediately shifts the viewing angle based on the pixels on the screen to just you. It makes it narrower. But what's even cooler is that you can like just pixel shift. You can privacy display specific apps or even notifications. So you could be looking at your phone normally and like a notification, which may be something you don't want the person next to you to see. Maybe you're planning a party for them. That notification will be blacked out.
Of course. The party excuse. The party excuse. That always comes up.
Whatever. But also, like, good God, this is great. This would also solve the phones in a theater problem for a lot of people, too. Like, if you were off to the side of somebody, you probably wouldn't notice them being on their phone. Only if you were, like, right behind them. This is super cool, super useful, consumer-friendly, and something I think, like, every phone carrier will, like, phone maker will copy eventually. What did you think, Igor?
Yeah, and to that point, like, it's going to be really easy to copy because this is just Samsung Display that made this, right? And so all a company like Apple has to do is buy up, you know, the supply and put it in their display. So that's great, right? Like, this is one of the areas where Samsung's vertical integration really is a boon to the industry because it's so easy to source these parts. But beyond that, like, I think the problem with the S26 family at this point is that, like, Samsung, there's so little ambition in other parts. Mm-hmm. You know, a phone I reviewed last year, the OnePlus 15, it had a 7,000 milliampere battery, right? Wow. Like, where is the, like, Samsung phone with a giant battery like that? Like, that is what I want, right? Like, mm-hmm. And, like, some of the batteries on, like, the S26, I believe it is, like, 4,300 or 500. Mm-hmm. In any case, that's like by 2026 standard, that's like nothing, right? Like, and yeah, the chip is more efficient and all these things, but truly, like, I think there's just no ambition to the other parts of this. It's weird
because this is the company that's also pioneered folding phones, and they have a tri-fold phone. Like, they are doing ambitious designs in other ways, right? Although the folding phones also don't look— it's cool that they fold. It's cool that they've refined that. But the Galaxy Fold does not look actually that sleek to me. It just looks kind of boring when it's folded up. It's the mechanism that's cool. At one point during this event, they had like the sort of history of Samsung phones going all the way back to like the first Galaxy to the S3 to everything over. And I was like, that did really make me think, man, yeah, things really changed really quickly. And Samsung really innovated really quickly at times. And now they're just like, we've got a boring rectangle. And the change they did this year is they changed the type of metal that's on the Ultra. That's the main thing. And you can argue Apple does this too, right? Apple's phones have not really changed significantly over the last couple generations. But also, like, there are little functional tweaks and camera tweaks, I think, make them better. Is there anything else going on with the S26, Igor?
You know, so I wrote the S26 and S26 Plus story, and there's like some AI features they've improved, but yeah, a lot of it is just really table stakes at this point. Again, like, I guess, you know, the one interesting thing here is that the European variant has, and the Korean variant, they have their new Exynos chip, which is the first 2-nanometer chip. So for nerdy people like us, I think it'll be interesting to see how this compares to the Snapdragon, which is a 3-nanometer chip.
Yeah.
And Samsung famously, like, they've kind of been up and down with their kind of in-house foundry, where there's like been some really great chips. The one that they have in the S25 FE is really great. But there's also like been ones that have just had terrible, like, power efficiency. Mm-hmm. So I'm really curious, like, it'd be great if there was not just Qualcomm, right? If it was like everyone just and MediaTek, right? Like, if there was a third player that people actually went to, i.e. Samsung, I think there would be just lead to more interesting market and more innovation.
I agree. This is the problem with like not enough competition. I think it's genuinely weird to sell the same phone model with very different brains inside of it in different locations. Like, there's going to be serious performance differences, serious battery efficiency differences there. Very strange. They've been doing that for a while too. And as somebody trying, I'd be worried if I was trying to buy these phones about like what I'd be getting there. Yeah.
Yeah. And there's no reason for it anymore, right? Mm-hmm. Like, they used to do it because Qualcomm had much better CDMA support, and like, we're like a decade removed from when that was like an issue, right? Like, where it's like your Verizon phone could, like, you know, you couldn't, you know, it was much more complicated to switch between Verizon and AT&T Now it's just everyone uses the same standard, right?
So I don't know, the Galaxy S26. That's where we are with these things. Also, we got the Galaxy Buds 4 and Galaxy Buds 4 Pro, which look a lot more AirPod-like now. I guess they have like big stems. I feel like the design just looks different than before. But again, it's they are saying better audio quality, better ANSI. That's it. That's what you're expecting here, folks. It's a headphone refresh. There's only so much they can do. So there's that. There were some Google AI features too. Perplexity AI is an option. Let me see here. Also, offloading multi-step tasks to Gemini. Long press the power button, ask Gemini to help book you a ride home or reorder your last meal. I cannot wait to see how this screws up people's lives. That's going to be a real fun thing. Like one thing was like, I can't make sense of like all these orders, all these things people want for my dinner. I want like the AI to just order the dinner for me. Do you know how nerve-wracking that is as a parent? To first of all, just doing the order, making sure everything's good. If one thing is wrong by the time that order arrives, dinner is ruined for somebody in your family. And depending on how emotional or young that person is, things can escalate to a bad night. You don't want AI to be the thing decide making those decisions and just doing it all for you. Like at the very least, we have modernized a delivery technology to the point where you click a couple buttons and then something will arrive magically. But at least you do enough of the manual process to get it right, you know, yourself, or double check it.
That's why the single and or child-free people need to throw themselves on this grenade, order things via Bixby, and then report to us how screwed up your order gets. Also, tag Samsung and Google in this and see if you can build yourself a class action. It would be the dumbest class action of all time, but still.
Also, not that hard to book yourself a ride home via Lyft or Uber. And those are things where you want to make sure the location is correct. You want to make sure things are right. You want to know where to stand. Like, we cannot optimize our lives to the point where AI is doing the basic thinking for us. And then, like, problems will arise as we understand less about how our lives are working.
It's automating things that have already been, like, smoothed down to, like...
I hit a button and a car appears in front of me. That's already easy.
Yeah.
Good God.
So before we move off of the Samsung talk, I would like to brainstorm some ideas of what you would use the privacy display for. Banking is the free bingo square. Also, why are you doing banking things out in the open? Can't you wait until you get home for that?
That's real old millennial speak, Ben. Do you only make big purchases on your laptop? Do you only book plane tickets on your laptop?
Yes.
Yeah, see? That's what I'm saying. You could do banking stuff wherever. Banking on your phone is so much safer.
That is a sign of like, oh, I wish that I was jet-setting so much that I needed to pay my credit card bill like while I was in the back of an Uber because I'm on my way to a speaking engagement or something. Like, okay, banking, whatever. I'd use it for pretty much all social media. And especially like Slack. Instagram and Blue Sky, depending on who you follow, especially if you follow some people who, I don't know, sometimes they post fan art. Sometimes that fan art is a little NSFW or something.
Ooh, an NSFW filter would be awesome.
You're sitting on public transit next to a 5-year-old, and you don't want to like beam into their brain the fact that furries can be that naked despite having fur.
It's a great I'm so glad they've already announced it. It's like it can be programmed like to what this feature applies to, because there's so many things. Like if I'm in a specific Reddit channel, I would love for it to be optimized further. I think at the very least, just, hey, if you're in Reddit, just turn it on. Just turn it on. Whatever is happening, just turn it on.
Igor, what would you use it for?
I don't know if I would use it for this, but I feel like this is going to be a boon to the government, because wasn't there recently, they took a picture, was it of Pete Hackett's smartphone.
They do it all the time. The reporters with the telephoto lenses are always taking photos of like documents or things on people's phones because they're holding it up like idiots.
And I don't think as a society we realize how big these phones are and that they're just, you're just a walking billboard of your like private life, you know. And you know, like I think just hiding your conversations with your friends and family, I think and there's this great friends and essay that he wrote many years ago about calling in public, right? I called to say I love you. It's in the MIT review. And I think it does, like, we broadcast so much of our personal life now in public with phones that it's just become, like, I don't want to hear or, like, see such intimate conversations when I'm on the metro, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it also depends, like, that's a real city thing versus, like, people in the suburbs and how your proximity to people is so very different. It is funny that the company who created the phablet, the company who basically started the big-ass phone trend, is like, hey, maybe a problem with these big screens everywhere.
Well, okay, yeah. You can take my example, and instead of a five-year-old, you can put your five-year-old.
No, certainly. There's certainly some things I would love to just like automatically hide from my kids. Banking stuff in general. Like, yeah, turn it on for your banking app. I would love a real theater mode where it not only like completely narrowed the screen, but like lowered the brightness as like low as possible too. Like there's so many things. Once you add this technology into display, so many things we could be doing here. And from the hands-ons that people have been writing up, it seems like it, when you turn on, it doesn't really affect brightness that much. Like it's barely noticeable that this feature is on. So that also gets rid of like the major downside of using a privacy film. It kills the screen. If you're using a privacy film on any device, it looks so much dimmer, grosser, colors are washed out. Like it looks bad. So the fact that they can do this, this is super cool. This is the coolest thing Samsung has done in a very long time. Yeah.
Last thing, I'd also use it for literally every dating app. I'm not sure if either of you have been in the dating app and also public transit era in your lives, but the feeling of being on a dating app when you know people can just like look at your screen for a couple of seconds is mortifying.
When Tinder first popped up, like it was all over the subway. It was kind of gross. Just being people, yeah, yeah. Like, oh, I know what you're doing. I know where you're going, folks. That's Samsung's hardware. All right, let us know if you're excited or are you just excited about the privacy display? Because I think that's genuinely, genuinely cool. Okay, let's move on to some other news. And hey, there's a bit of a fight going on. AI, of course, is always the thing. And there's an ongoing battle between Anthropic, maker of Claude AI, and the Pentagon, apparently, the U.S. government. There's been an ongoing dispute about how they want their technology to be used. So Pentagon wants to use Claude for everything, including things like automated strikes, surveillance, whatever. Anthropic specifically didn't want their technology to be used for surveillance and autonomous warfare. The Pentagon has given Anthropic until Friday to let it use Claude as it sees fit. This is a weird, messy situation, and also messy because Anthropic is, like, we've talked about all these AI companies. They're the one that's trying to have a sort of a backbone, I guess, and be like, hey, you got to use our stuff for good. Although there was also a report I saw from Time recently from that said Anthropic removed some of the, like, more... basically their mission statement to say that they want to build safe tech. Like apparently they're walking that back too, just like Google did. What do you guys think about this? This seems like a mess. I don't think it's going to end well for Anthropic.
So last year I wrote an article that I was really proud of, which was, it was centered around Trump's AI action plan. And I warned that this would exactly something like this would happen. And basically what's happening is that, like, you know, these, it's a political test, right? Is like, will you do AI as we deem is fit, right? And I you know, I said in that article, like, you know, the AI action plan for all, like, it gave a lot of handouts for AI companies, but it came with this very big caveat, which is like, this is the situation we're seeing now. And I, if I, ha- like, I just don't know, like, there's no way for Anthropic to like really like walk a fine line here, right? It's either they like capitulate and or they just say no. But the reality is then like the government has ways to force that they comply. So this is just not a good situation in any like way, shape or form.
It's I'm seeing in the chat people are saying Anthropic may have just given in. I'm not seeing that in the news. If you guys can drop that link,
yeah,
that'd be
yeah,
great.
No, I just looked around, so I cannot confirm that for myself.
But I do have more about, so like part of it was yesterday they announced they're ditching their core safety promise, and that specific bit here I'm reading from CNN. Instead of self-imposed guardrails constraining its development of AI models, Anthropic is adopting a non-binding safety framework that it says can and will change. So basically it's going to try to be a little more flexible about how it thinks of AI safety. From what I can see, they still have not made a decision around the Pentagon stuff. But I do think this is something, this particular loosening this guardrail is certainly like a response to this. Like they want the ability to be more flexible, right?
This isn't the only AI in defense bit of news. We also saw just yesterday, actually, excuse me, 2 days ago, that the U.S. military will reportedly use Grok in its classified systems. Grok, is this real? Grok, can you explain this? Are you serious? But also, this isn't so surprising because it was already happening, kind of, sort of. If you look at any of the like screens that were up in the little situation room during the Maduro smash and grab last month, you'll see that like they had X literally up like to see the reaction and may have been using Grok already, like the unsecured version of Grok too. I don't know. That's scary.
Our government is being run by ignorance and like flawed AI.
This shouldn't be so surprising. Yeah, like Elon Musk is a major patron of the president. So of course, like in an administration like this, someone is going to end up getting a kickback. But I think the more interesting headline is from New Scientist that says AIs can't stop recommending nuclear strikes in war game situations. This is a study from King's College London where they tested GPT 5.2, Claude Sonnet 4, Gemini 3 Flash against each other in simulated war games, and they were given an escalation ladder allowing them to choose like actions ranging from diplomatic protests and complete surrender to full strategic nuclear war, and in 95% of these simulated games, at least one tactical nuke was deployed by the AI models. So if we're going back to this idea of Anthropic is better, they did test Claude with this. How's that for machines of loving grace?
I wish I had something intelligent to say, but it's, you know, I think this is why we can't, like, you know, like, I think partially the issue is that, like, you know, these systems are built for easy escalation, right? And, you know, I think historically, if you look back at this, like, you know, there have been many moments when we've been close to nuclear war. And mm-hmm. I think just like getting a trigger happy AI to bolt on a trigger happy AI that can't really comprehend the scale mm-hmm. of what this would mean for humanity, is just a recipe for disaster.
I believe like all those moments where like we were very close to launching nukes and things, they came down to humans being like, no, like, hey, let's double check this. Let's think about what's happening here.
The two big ones, I think, were, of course, the Cuban Missile Crisis, and then also that time when Russian radar bounced off the moon in a weird way, and they were like, oh my God, there are missiles coming. And there was literally one guy who was like, let's double check this. Let's make absolutely sure. And that day, he saved the entire human race.
Kind of wild. I believe, was that story believe may have happened in around Massachusetts. I forget if that's the thing.
The moon story? No, I'm pretty sure that was...
That was like straight to like NORAD.
No, that was on the Russian side.
Oh, on the Russian side.
On the U.S. side. Yeah.
Not good. AI. It does seem like every week we're like, hey, look at what AI is ruining this time. Not really having a good hit of not a great success rate over here for this technology.
Well, yeah. And so like you're paying all of this money to like a third party vendor, you know, Anthropic or OpenAI or anything. Like they're going to be paying, the government is going to end up paying contractor rates, which is probably higher than anything else, because you also need to make sure that you're paying for the infrastructure to properly secure all of these channels or install like local instances at like government facilities. So you're paying a bunch of money to have AM from I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream or Gandhi from Civilization just in your computer systems. Sure. Okay.
It's all so stupid. It's all so stupid. What else is stupid? Prediction markets. Very stupid. We were talking about like the sort of like easy way for insider trading to happen in prediction markets. And just this week, Bobby Allen over at NPR reported that an editor who works for Mr. Beast, or who worked, I don't know if they currently do, identified as Artem Kaptur, has been suspended from the prediction market Kalshi. And reported to federal regulators for insider trading, Kalshi officials said on Wednesday. This is the first time Kalshi has revealed the results of an investigation into market manipulation. And hopefully it's not going to be the last time. I do wonder what was the inciting incident that made this happen?
There was something like, I think it was just suspicious how good his predictions were.
Oh, yeah.
And the amount of money. Yeah.
He had near perfect trading success on bets about the YouTuber's videos with low odds, making the wagers appear suspicious, according to officials. We've talked about this. Like, there were bets against the invasion on Venezuela. There are bets on all sorts of things that are apparently much higher stakes than $4,000. It is funny that this is the one.
I mean, we wanted to talk with Bobby, but like, the tech didn't work out. But like, Bobby was talking about how there are certain users on these prediction market platforms that other power users, other day traders, just know not to contradict. Like, that's just a widely known thing, and it's probably because they have insider information. So if you're making some kind of bet on like how long a political speech is going to be, and you know, user 5792 ends up getting it right like 80% of the time, they are probably a staffer and they haven't been banned yet. Which also comes back to the idea of, if you do sports betting or prediction market stuff and have not been banned from the platform, you are a mark.
And it's just crazy, like, the degree to which all of this has been normalized in our society. You know, like I hadn't watched SportsCenter in a while, and then to see betting odds.
It's awful. It's awful. CNN has Kalshi prediction figures on its live feed, typically. Yep.
I saw Harry Enten talking about that, and I'm like, man, dude, you must have sold out. Like, you did sell out real hard. I thought you were just a numbers guy. It also makes me think about Pete Rose, the guy, the baseball player who got permanently banned from baseball for betting on baseball games. Who's saying that professional players aren't doing that now, especially because this stuff is going to crypto wallets? It would be easy enough for not the player themselves, but someone who is, you know, the player's friend, somebody in their general entourage, placing bets for them infrequently enough that they are making a good amount of money, but not a suspicious amount of money. And there's nothing we can do about it right now.
We will be on this. This is certainly not the last time we're going to be talking about prediction markets. You guys want to also discuss the story about Discord. Discord is delaying its age verification to address user concerns. People started freaking out once the news came down that they plan to enact an age verification policy, specifically around the privacy concerns. I saw a lot of people canceling their Discord memberships. What's that called?
Nitro.
Yeah. All that fun stuff. I wish I could. I don't know. I don't spend much time on Discord. What is going on at this point? How are they responding?
Well, the most recent news is that Discord is like, we're not going to do this, maybe for a while, maybe forever. Of course, the response online is, they're just waiting until this blows over and then they're going to try again. But I think the most interesting thing is the process of how we got here. Of course, context always matters. So like, at the beginning of the month, on February 9th, about 17 days ago from the time of this recording, Discord said, starting soon, every single user is going to have a teen-appropriate experience by default if they don't submit a photo for age verification. They don't want to deal with like multi-tier things. They're just going to give everybody the same experience. And that pissed a bunch of people off because this is something that is being instituted years into people using this platform, and things get crazy on Discords too. So like the idea that you couldn't log into your favorite whatever Discord really rubbed people the wrong way. So people, yes, were like canceling Nitro. I saw one person say that, oh, it would be really bad if Californians who use Discord contacted the office of the Attorney General and reported, you know, potential violations to specific state laws, citing a recent breach from a few months ago where a terabyte and a half of user data and millions of IDs were leaked. But who could say for sure? So that was one possibility of recourse. But it's not going to stop things entirely. Also, it would have taken, you know, a while because bureaucracy just takes a while. So a bunch of other users did research, including this one hacker, Celeste, and a group of other people, but it seems like Celeste was spearheading this, looked into the vendor that was doing the age verification facial recognition for Discord. This is a company called Persona Identities, or just Persona. And they found that every internal model, every API call, and every permission check, every workflow reports you to the feds, according to Celeste. They had multiple different ways of looking at your face and figuring out, okay, should you be on this list? Should you be on that list? It connected to financial things. It was horrifying. By now, it also shouldn't be surprising that this company is backed by Peter Thiel.
It all goes back to the tech oligarchs, ultimately.
Yeah.
Trying to destroy things. Always.
So just a little note about Celeste, because I'm a big fan now.
I love the website. Yeah.
I want to talk for a second about the website, but like, I don't know about your circles, but like, this is the second time I'm talking about furries this episode. People talk about gay furry hackers, and this is yet another gay furry hacker. If you click around on Celeste's website, especially some of the like desktop icons, because this website is very much like Windows 95 themed, it has direct links to like Fur Affinity and like other furry stuff. They've got like a kitty cursor pet that chases your mouse around. This is the most woo-woo website that I've seen since Maya Arson Crimeu, who leaked the U.S. no-fly list.
I miss it. I'm sharing it on the stream right now.
Oh, wait. Yep. Ooh, yeah, amazing.
I love it. This is how I grew up on the internet. This is 1990s GeoCities, people doing random stuff. I miss all this. You can't hear the music, but the music is unstopped. Like, I can't stop the music. Oh, it's down here.
Oh, no, you can. You can go down to, I think it's by the bottom right corner, and then press pause.
I love websites. Used to be fun, man. They used to be cool. Let's
do the weird thing. Wes Jackson says, come on, Ben, I'm at work right now. Let's keep it clean. What's not clean about gay furry hackers? That's just like,
that's absolutely clean.
Yeah, no, that's just good, clean fun here on the internet.
Oh, there's a Windows 98 start.
Oh, yeah. It. Yeah. Like this website is amazing. I wouldn't click around too much on it just because I haven't done the deepest dive. Yeah. So like, let's keep it clean for the stream. Let's make sure that our stream doesn't get banned on YouTube. But, I love this website. I am in full support of people who want to defend their rights. The really, really important thing when it comes to Discord and this facial verification, age verification issue is that how long has Discord been one of the primary gathering places for gamers and internet folks? Nearly 10 years now, maybe? Communities of queer and trans people all over the world, and especially in the US, have gathered on Discord. Nobody wants their identifying information leaked, especially because that could put you on a literal list in the US. So it's not just basic privacy, I don't want to give my face. It's this could be a fast track to further ostracization, being ostracized further by the American federal government. And that's really not good.
And I'd also add, I think so much of what we're seeing, you spoke about context, is they're preparing for an IPO. And I think the main thing that Discord really, I think, overestimated is just they took on way too much venture capital, right? Mm-hmm. And
always
this is a story as old as time, right? Yeah. How do you repay that? And it comes back to you have to make your platform objectively worse for users, right?
That literal inshitification, right? So, because there are two paths for Discord to make any possible money. Either you make Nitro so irresistible that people pay for it, or maybe you license specific emojis or something that people developed on the platform. And part of the EULA is probably you guys don't actually own those emojis. Yes, you had very fertile beds of culture in each of these Discord servers, but surprise, your IP is our IP. But at the very end of the funnel ends up being selling user data. Just raw user data and what people are playing and what they wish listed, because Discord has its own game store that's trying to compete with Steam. It seems it's all going in this direction, especially because they need to get $200 million back anyway. That's their VC burden right now. It's privacy. It's also defending queer and trans and other weirdo rights and benign weirdos. Let's make sure I
love the weirdos.
Make that absolutely queer.
Yes.
Absolutely queer. but
this is the problem of basically moving all of our conversations, by the way, to platforms, right? Platforms where we just have to hope that they keep things secure. Back in the days of message boards and IRC, where it's protocols kind of managing things. People still had to manage that data, but at least it wasn't as the impulse was, the police could still try to claim that data from somebody who was running a server or something, but it wasn't as widespread, I guess. It didn't seem like the fear of data getting out there was as bad back then. Let's go back to those days. Discord is just busy IRC. That's why I don't spend
time on Discord. Yeah, and I could pretty much guarantee you that Celeste and their friends aren't using Discord. They're using a IRC instance that's hosted locally on someone's
secure
closet machine or something.
They're talking on an encrypted platform of some kind at this point. But anyway, thank you guys. We will be keeping an eye on that. And this reminds me, I have to re-up my Discord stuff. It's the one account. It's the one account where I lost the two-factor device and the keys. So I had to start a whole new Discord account on an email I barely use. So that's probably why I'm never in Discord. Let's move on to what's going on around in Engadget. And Mr. Steve Dent graciously reviewed the Asus ProArt GoPro Edition PX13. this is a specific GoPro version or GoPro like tied version of the PX13, which is their new laptop running Intel's latest CPUs. What's notable is that this one has 120 gigabytes of RAM. In this day and age, in this economy, 128 gigabytes of RAM. And just from everything Steve covered here, this seems like the perfect productivity PC if you need Windows and if you can afford it. But I'm pretty sure like whatever the hardware you're getting in this thing is going to be is still going to be much cheaper than specking out, you know, a MacBook Pro with equivalent sort of hardware. It starts at $3,000, but I'm sure that price just goes up and up and up. Steve says the display lacks brightness, even though it's a beautiful OLED. The fans are loud under load, but for what it is, I don't know, if you're doing a lot of heavy, especially like video editing work, this looks like a pretty good machine. Let's move on to what we're working on. Igor, anything you want to shout out?
Yeah, so next week I'll have the a Pixel 10a review. I'm also working on a scoop that I just, for obvious reasons, can't talk about. And then I'd love to really shout out an article I just spent weeks working on, which was our orbital data centers in space. Could they work? But they'll probably ruin the planet in the process. I interviewed 6 different sources on this. And the more I worked on it, you know, the more I just became like, I felt like I just kind of scratched the surface. But so, yeah, I'm just really proud of this piece. So if, you know, if you haven't read it, please do and tell me what you think.
Awesome. Is the idea that it would be better than data centers on Earth? Like, would they be able to transmit data more efficiently if it's all just floating out there?
Well, it essentially comes down to 2 kind of things, which is, you know, solar energy is cheaper or more efficient in space. But really, it comes down to, I think, for people like Elon Musk, is like it's controlling really these orbits that are really valuable. And, you know, I know we think of space as this infinite thing, but orbits, there's actually a finite amount of satellites that you can put in a certain orbit because they're a danger to each other, right? And so this one, I think this is like, Elon has like talked about how this is him like helping humanity advance. But I think really at the end of the day, as is usually the case with Elon, it's really just about enriching himself. So yeah, I get into some of those things and how detrimental it would be to the planet and the environment if this they were to go through with this.
Awesome. Just making sure you're understanding, are you talking about Kessler syndrome or are you talking about something else?
Kessler syndrome is one of the things, but there are other factors that are just like also as important.
Okay. Looking forward to reading that. Everybody go read it. If you're listening to this, you owe Igor a read of this piece.
It seems cool. And I love the art we got for this too. It's very cool. Thank you, Igor.
And for me, what I'm working on is just being very thankful that we got to episode 300. Like, I remember starting the Engadget podcast like file on my machine, and I just instinctively put like episode number 001 and 002. And I was like, let's see if we'll even get to 3 digits. Like,
let's see.
Yeah, and we've gotten to like 300 episodes. That's really amazing. Thank you for sticking with us. I'll thank the chat and everyone off of the audio version of the show, but we really love that we have been able to make this show for 300 whole episodes. So let's get to picks. Devendra, or actually Igor. What is your pop culture pick this week?
I'm just really excited to play Resident Evil Requiem. That comes out tomorrow. So yeah, I will report back once I've had a chance to play it.
It's been getting good reviews. That poor Polygon review has been like just pummeled. I don't think he deserved that. It you know,
when you just, bring, it's very whiplashy, that review.
It is. It goes all over the place. I get it. I get how tough it is to write a review. But the overall reviews of that game looks good. I don't know what it is with me. Like, I grew up loving the Resident Evil games. I played all the early ones, but man, the new ones, I just feel like I get bored because I feel like I've done this before. But we'll see. I'm intrigued. I'm intrigued by the new characters, Igor. Anything else you want to shout out?
Nope, that's it.
All right. I got a couple of things. Night of the Seven Kingdoms just finished, which is the Game of Thrones spinoff series, short series. It's only 6 episodes. It is glorious. It is great. This is the best stuff that I love from Game of Thrones. No need for dragons. I did not like the House of the Dragon show at all because it made the dragons less special. Everybody had a dragon. The dragons were everywhere. It just felt a little too much. This show is
simple. Was not a house of one or two dragons, though, Devendra. Come on.
It's true. It's right there in the title. It felt boring. This one is like a small-scale story in basically a single town with a handful of characters, and it's beautiful. Really well-made, really well-written, and well-acted. Check it out. And also check out Industry, which is in its 4th season on HBO Max. These two shows were like back-to-back, too. So like, what a Sunday night. But I've talked about this before. I think Industry is one of the best things on TV, and it has gotten so good. So good this season. Check it out. Like, the finale is next week. If you've been watching before, wouldn't be that long to catch up. Yeah. And also, yeah, I saw Scarlet, which is the new movie from Mamoru Hosoda. And I wish I liked it more. It's sort of like a gender-bent twist on Hamlet that goes into like the afterlife. You know, princess's need for revenge has her chasing her uncle into the afterworld. And I think it's very pretty. I don't think it really amounts to much. And there is a love interest dude who is so boring in this movie. So boring. So I like Hosoda's movies. Some of them are hit or miss. Like, I feel like sometimes he just like doesn't really land the themes properly or his characters or his narratives. This is certainly a beautiful movie. It's in theaters now, so if you can see it on the big screen, I'd recommend it. I just wish I just wish I liked it more.
Thanks again, everybody, for listening, and thanks for listening to our 300th episode. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our former managing editor, Terrence O'Brien. The podcast is produced by me, Ben Elman. You can find Igor online at
Igor, BONIFACIC at Blue Sky.
You can find Devendra online at
I'm at Devendra on Blue Sky, and I talk about movies and TV at the Filmcast at thefilmcast.com.
If you want to tell me about really rigorously fact-checked nonfiction books, you can find me on Blue Sky at Hey Bellman. Email us at podcast@engadget.com. Leave us a review on iTunes and subscribe on anything that gets podcasts. That includes Spotify.
That's real old millennial speak, Ben. Do you only make big purchases on your laptop? Do you only book plane tickets on your laptop?
Yes.
Yeah, see? That's what I'm saying.